Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
This,
here's John Williams.
Be a good place for a radio show. We're live at WGNradio.com. Thanks for tuning in. Hey, it's John. It's 111. And the Allstate Skyline Studio. We're here till 3. Remember, when White Sox baseball's on the radio, we're on the stream, as we say it. Thanks for finding us here. And never, ever, ever forget that we never stop doing these little radio shows of ours. So if there's something else on the radio, like Northwestern football or basketball or the White Sox or the Blackhawks, we're still cranking them out here at WGNradio.com. With some exceptions, but that's the rule, and certainly you don't miss Rokan's show or mine just because baseball's on. Although that's been some pretty fun baseball, so you got two options there. And thanks for being part of this. There's lots to talk about today. Phil Vitale will join us, the restaurant critic at the Chicago Tribune. He's got some red, white, and blue suggestions for you for the holiday if you're dining out with family or friends. We'll also play back part of the Mincing Rascals podcast. And we normally do that on Saturdays, and we normally record it on Thursdays. But we did it today because the holiday's tomorrow. And Eric Zorn said something in the Mincing Rascals podcast, and you guys kind of agreed with him, and I just thought, I can't believe you guys are saying this.
You're talking to me, John. I'm sorry. I just turned on my headphones.
Fair enough, Steve. No, I'm just mentioning that we're going to play back part of the Mincing Rascals. And I'm usually the one who's saying these ridiculous things and everybody gets angry or blows up. But Zorn was saying that it's pretty much okay. And Justin Kaufman agreed to text while driving if you do it at a light, if you do it at a stoplight.
Oh, I was gone for that part.
That was the responsible way to text, they said. And I'm like, no, you guys, it can't be. So hear this out and then tell me if they're right or not.
Are you going to play it now?
No.
I was sitting at waiting for a train yesterday, freight train, slow freight train.
You're breaking the law if you're looking at your phone.
Which is ridiculous. I'm sorry, that's crazy.
What?
I'm sitting in park for 5 minutes, and if I were to look down at my phone to check the weather forecast or an email, I mean, I just think, I understand the law, but it's not a perfect fit.
I don't want to be 1,000 years old on this one, but I just can't believe that you guys are so... Well, the biggest danger and the biggest frustration we have are people with their phones in the car. They're not paying attention, the lights turn green, the train's gone by, and you're still sitting there texting Tim or looking at the forecast. And everybody's okay with that but me.
Well, I'm generally not okay with it, but, you know, when I get in my car in the morning, I turn on my GPS and to see what the traffic's going to be downtown, right?
Yeah.
It's four buttons. Hit navigation, hit destination, previous destinations, hit set as destination. That's all time when I'm staring at my navigation screen in my car. And that's legal. It doesn't make sense that it's like motorcycle helmets, you know. It doesn't make sense. If you're so worried about it, why are those touch screens in cars legal too then?
We'll get to this in a little more detail when we play back the logic train that you and the rest of these people were on. Before we go to Thomas Jefferson, third president of the United States, who's on hold, give me 60 seconds to play for you the mashup that I was talking about with Bill and Wendy. So get a number two pencil and get an old person and get a young person, because some of these songs are new and some of them are old. But I want you to tell me how many of these 10 songs you can name. They all have the name America or the word American or America in the title, but one. 9 of the 10 have the word America or American in the title. All 9 of them, so 9 of the 10. I don't care what the title of the song is. I want you to tell me who the artists are. In 3, 2, 1, whoa.
So bye bye, Miss American Pie.
Oh, nice. She wants a young American.
Okay, so there's your 10. You know who this last one is, right, Steve? Who's singing the last song in the mix?
Ray Charles.
Ray Charles!
Yes, he did! Hey, brotherhood.
I'll play it again in a few minutes. After we talk to Thomas Jefferson, I'll give you another listen. Get your number two pencils or whatever it is you use to record things with, and then tell us how many of these songs you can name by the artist. And we gave you one. That's Ray Charles. I wonder if the third president of the United States, Thomas Jefferson's any good at this contest. Mr. Jefferson, are you there?
That was. I'm trying to decide whether that was Bach or Mozart.
Bach and Mozart were not represented in that list.
I thought it was maybe later Bach.
No, not even the later Bach. Not even the one where he broke up with the original band and went out on his own.
That was his farewell tour. He did 12 of them.
So, like, really, who would be the contemporary artist? When you all got together and were listening to music, and I don't know how you would have even done that now that I think about that, but how did Thomas Jefferson and friends listen to music?
Well, I had a fiddle, a violin. I had two. I had a regular violin and a what's called a kit, a small traveling violin, and when we went to parties or to people's homes, if you could make music, you were expected to participate, to entertain. And all young women were taught to either sing or to play the pianoforte or maybe the harpsichord. And so music was always live, of course. There was no recorded music. And anyone who could make music would be called upon. You know, we had the dinners, and then there was the women withdrew, and the men would drink and talk about politics, and then the men would go join the women in a room, and that's when the music would begin. So the artists of my time would have been two. There would have been Corelli and Handel and Bach, and Mozart was coming. I did not know of Beethoven, but his music was already beginning to make a stir in Europe. I don't think I would have liked Beethoven very much. And then on the other hand, there was folk music, frontier reels and adaptations of Scottish ballads and the kind of music you would hear, say, in a folk concert or a bluegrass concert, even in your own time.
So the music stars would be these classic composers whose music you knew of, but still it would be dependent on how well somebody locally performed it or some local musicians who did folk songs.
That is correct. So, for example, I wrote a letter about going to a Christmas dinner party that lasted for, you know, this would be like spend a couple of weeks at someone's house, and there were a bunch of us, young Virginians, and Patrick Henry was there. This is really when I first met him. He was a great frontier fiddler. He could not have been a concert violinist, but he had mastered the fiddle, and he was also a raconteur and a storyteller and a person who could, using his charisma, could gather around 20 or 30 people and entertain them for an evening. And so he would perform, but he would not perform Bach. He would be performing fiddle music, frontier music. And there were jokes, and there were jests, and there were sing-alongs, and rounds, and so on.
But
we did not have recording artists in my time, I think it's fair to say.
So, Mr. President, then, though, you know, here today, all of us would recognize Handel. But Handel was at your time or just before your time, and most of the people who lived at the same time as you never heard of him, right? Or
That's
never
correct.
Never heard his music.
That's correct.
It's John, don't you think that's odd that we know the music better now than
people
who were alive when it was being made?
I think now that you mention it. Well, the music just couldn't travel. I mean, how do any of us consume music? We don't perform music for each other. It's recorded and we listen to recordings of it. Yeah, so if you were a contemporary of you, it might take a while for that music to travel overseas or to other countries, right?
It might never get to the frontier in a place like Pennsylvania or New York or Virginia, but you would have been able to hear it in Philadelphia and in Boston. So what would happen is that Americans would travel abroad. It was very rare at that time, and they would come back and say, oh, it's all the rage in Paris. They're listening to this music, and then they would try to get the sheet music. I had one of the largest collections of sheet music in the New World, and then they would try to piece it out on their own local instruments. But music was probably a bigger part of our lives than it is of yours, but it was communal in a way that it is not in yours. The idea of a person with earbuds would it not have seemed like a useful thing in my era?
There's only two places that Americans gather to sing music now. There's only two places. You talk about communal singing in the rounds, round campfires, things like that. We don't do that. We don't really sing together, but for two places. Are you guys thinking of the two places I'm thinking of? We do it at church, and fewer people go to church now than in the past, so that's a fading art for a lot of people. And we do it at baseball games. We do it at baseball games. We sing the national anthem, and we sing Take Me Out to the Ball Game at Cubs games, in fact. And then at the end of the game, when the Cubs win, we all sing a song as well. And that is one of the nicest experiences. Everybody knows the words, and it's communal, and it's joyful, and it's celebratory, and that's it. That's the only time we all sing songs together.
Well, how often do you sing that last song?
Not as much in June as we would have liked. I'll tell you, the team's not doing that well.
Let me tell you something about this, that I can give you one historical point that may really please your listeners, that right. When Lewis and Clark were stuck, so on the return journey, they got stuck at the base of the Rocky Mountains because of heavy winter snows, and they had to wait almost 6 weeks. They were with the Nez Perce Indians in what's now Idaho. And to while away the time, they had horse races and shooting matches and sprinting races and hurdles and sort of a kind of an Olympics between the Nez Perce and the Corps of Discovery. But one of the games they played was called Prisoner's Base. Prisoner's Base. And that is probably the beginnings of American baseball.
Oh, no kidding. I thought you were going to say hide and go seek. Prisoner's Base. So they were hitting about a round object or something like that?
Right, try to clear your mind of what you think when you think of baseball. Imagine there are these stations, these bases, and people go to them, and then the idea is to advance all the way around to the home base, and so the ball is being pitched and hit. It's a kind of a cross between the British forms of this, cricket, and what became American baseball. It was much more informal. You didn't have your rules of three yet and all of that. But the idea was, that I guess it'd be like sandlot ball.
Yeah.
Somebody throws an object at the hitter who has a piece of wood, and he's trying to hit it in such a way that people can advance to the next base or advance home. So it bears the basic structure of your baseball, but, of course, none of its sophistication. And the ball would have been lobbed up to the person at home plate.
Thomas Jefferson's on the phone, noted music historian and baseball expert. He joins us on stage frequently in Chicago, once or twice a year. I think in this we just visited with him recently at the Tivoli Theater. I believe we're going to visit with somebody that came after you, and that is Teddy Roosevelt. Exactly 100 years after you were president, there was this guy named Teddy Roosevelt who is kind of the opposite of you. And we're going to join him on stage at the end of October of this year. So we're looking forward to that.
Well, that bothers me to think that I have to spend eternity on Mount Rushmore next to this fellow. He came 100 years after me, but he was loud, boisterous, obnoxious, aggressive, always punching somebody out in a saloon or a bar. He was a warmonger, and he was a Hamiltonian. He said that Hamilton was the greatest of all of the founding fathers, and that we need a large centralized government and a huge military force. He was everything that I warned us not to let happen to this, our happy republic, and now I have to spend eternity next to him in rock.
Funny that you've picked up on all of that, what with him coming after you and all, but he doesn't like you much either, so it's kind of mutual, and you're right. It's weird that the two of you are up there immortalized, but we're a big country, and maybe over time we have room for the two of you. The reason I called you today, though, Mr. Jefferson, is because America is going to celebrate the 4th of July. How about that? Or the day that you all signed your Declaration of Independence, tomorrow, we are going to celebrate America. And the president has scheduled a different take on the 4th of July celebration in Washington, D.C. this year. And the reason I thought of you was I was reading about it last night, and I saw that while this is not the most contemporary version of it, normally the presidents don't speak, Republican and donors will have best seating, so it's become a political event, it's become much about the current president. But it said that you had a military parade go by the White House, and you, I don't know, walked out the back door or whatever you did and watched it in 1801. So it's not like you weren't against this sort of thing. I wonder what your thoughts are about that and about this.
Well, I'm trying to think of what the 1804 version of a tank would be. But since I can't, I can tell you that I did designate the Marine Corps Band as the official music of the president. Of course, we had no other bands. The Marine Corps had the only band in town. And I urged them to play the best music that they could, and they did entertain. You know, I think you know, I opened the White House twice per year during my presidency for receptions, once on the 4th of July, which is our nation's birth date, and the other on January 1st, which is, you know, the end of one year and the beginning of another. And there were parades after a very limited fashion. They would not be regarded as a parade in your time. It would be more like a few musicians strolling along the mud of the unfinished Pennsylvania Avenue.
What do you make, then, of this sort of muscular celebration that we're going to have this year?
I'm a Republican with a small R. I think the national government should not show off. I don't think that the president should be a monarchical figure. I think we should keep politics out of the 4th of July. It is the one true moment that unifies every single American. In fact, it not only unifies every single American without party, without faction, without political affiliation, but it unifies every liberty-loving person on earth. This should be the one day in all of the calendar that represents the best of what America represents. And by that, I mean the little flame that we lit on the 4th of July, 1776, I believe will engulf all of the tyrannies of the world, the despots, the aristocrats, the monarchs, the autocrats, and eventually every people on earth will have a Bill of Rights, due process, trial by jury, adequate protection of property, etc. And so for any president to begin to behave like a monarch or a despot or a dictator is exactly undermining of the very purposes of the Declaration of Independence and the very symbolism of the 4th of July.
Well, it hasn't happened yet, so we're prejudging it. We know about the plans. There will be tanks and a military flyover. It will be more muscular, as I said. It will be military. But let's wait and hear what the president has to say, and maybe we'll talk about this again, but not your
Well, let me say to that just this one thing. It's not my business. I died in 1826. But if the president says anything about himself or his party or the greatness of his administration, then he will be violating the very idea and principle of Independence Day, because this is not about any president. I happened to be president between 1801 and 1809, and James Madison happened to be president between 1809 and 1817. These are historical accidents, but the one thing you must always cling to, no matter what else happens in our republic, is the document that Congress unanimously passed on the 4th of July that says whenever any form of government becomes destructive of the ends of the rights of man, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and institute new government.
That's Thomas Jefferson, third president of these United States. Teddy Roosevelt is almost certainly going to join us in October. If you think Jefferson's thoughts are interesting and wise and maybe a little controversial, wait till you hear Roosevelt on stage in the fall. As I let you go, Mr. President, I'm going to play the music mix one more time. 10 songs, all of them but one with the word America or American in the title. The question is, who is singing these songs?
So bye bye, Miss American Pie.
Oh, nice. And once a young American.
Why American boy, American boy.
We gave you Ray Charles at the end. Mr. Jefferson, how many of those can you correctly name? Thomas, are you there? He's gone.
Yes, he did. Hey, brother, who?
How many of those do you think you guys got?
I got all but, I think I have all but one and a half of them.
I have four, but you gave away one of the ones I knew.
So really three? No, but you would have had that anyway, so I'll give you that, four. Brian Altorfer, who works with Ro Khan, and Aleph Garris, who's my producer, and some of the other members of the staff I played for him, and said, okay. And it's just funny because there's such a generational divide, right? So if you're under 30, maybe you don't know some of those artists. And if you're over 50, maybe you don't know a couple of those artists, even if you recognize the music a little bit. But, you know, some of them you're just popping off real easy and some of them you aren't. I'm not sure how I would play this game. You can call or text and tell us how many of them you got. Whoever gets the most by, let's say, 2:30 wins the prize, which will be a pat on the back or something. But I'll play it again after the news, and let's see how well you can do at that. They're fun songs, aren't they? Steve, and the market's closed, right?
Yes, indeed.
And a record high on the Dow, huh?
The Dow and the Nasdaq, I believe, right?
Ah, how about them apples?
So we've overcome all the losses of December. No, really, because I think the previous record was set in October. Remember, we ended the year with a very bleak note.
Right. Oh, that's right.
So we've made that back now.
Yeah, when the president had said, I mean, it just as you sort of follow some of the ups and downs of the market, at one point the president said the market has never been higher, but it had been a year since it had gotten to that point. We were kind of even.
Yeah, I think we'd made it up earlier in the spring.
Yeah.
But we're above that now.
Look at that. Wow. Okay. Well, that's some good news as you head off to your barbecues. It's 1:39. Speaking of the 4th of July, we made a little musical mashup, and we said, can you name all 10 songs? And then Bill and Wendy and I were talking about it, and they said, nobody's going to get all 10. So just say whoever gets the most. And then Lauren called in from Wilmette. Hey, Lauren, this is John. You're on WGN Radio. How many of them do you think you have?
Well, I think I have all of them.
All right. Here we go. Here's the music mashup. Hold on, I'll get through the list, but
this is America. Don't catch us living on.
We just want the artist.
Bye bye, Miss American Pie.
Oh, sing once a young American.
You be my American boy, American boy.
So, Lauren in Wilmette, are you a music person, Lauren? You pretty good at this?
Well, I like music. I'm old enough to know most of the ones in the list.
Right.
I try to keep up with music, so I knew one of them is current, and two I had to look up.
Oh, really? But then you wrote down a lyric or something from it and
just
then
the
found
two
it?
Two words.
Okay,
yeah.
So number one was?
Neil Diamond.
America. Then you heard?
Simon and Garfunkel.
America. Then you heard
Childish Gambino.
Have you watched that video, by the way?
Childish Gambino?
Yeah.
I saw, I think, a preview of it somewhere, yeah.
Yeah.
I saw him premiere it on Saturday Night Live.
Oh, yeah, right.
The song.
Right, well, that's when he did the song. You watched the video. It's jarring. We talked a lot about This Is America, Childish Gambino. So there's number three. Then you got
John McClane.
American Pie. Why not? And then what have you got?
David Bowie.
Young Americans, right. Then what's after that?
Estelle.
Isn't that a fun song? We haven't played American Boy or thought about that song in a long time. Isn't that fun?
I didn't know that one.
Oh, that's it. Yeah, well, now you do. Number seven was?
Dave Matthews Band.
Yeah, American Baby. Then you got?
Guess Who.
Guess Who singing American Woman.
American
then you had,
Woman.
Right.
Arlo Guthrie.
Arlo Guthrie's Good Morning America, How Are You? Is actually called The City of New Orleans, so that's the one that doesn't have...
Steve Goodman.
Yeah, good for you. And then number 10 was...
You said Ray Charles.
Yeah, singing America the Beautiful. All right. Hey, wow. Lauren, nicely done.
Thank you.
What have I got on my prize list here for you? How about a limited edition of the Brightside Pin Yeah, let's give you the Bright Side pin. We give those away on Fridays, but I'm going to give you one of those from our friends at the Joint Relief Institute. Ooh, I've got a pair of pavilion seats to Ravinia, July 21st. They're showing Ghostbusters on the big screen, and the symphony orchestra is playing along, and our Dean Richards will lead a pre-concert discussion.
That would be great.
Tickets at Ravinia.org. We'll give you those, and I'll throw in a Lou Malnati's pizza, too, okay?
Fantastic. My favorite pizza.
Lou's is home of Chicago's best deep-dish pizza. They got 40 spots in Chicago. LouMalnati's.com if you want to order one. All right.
Fantastic.
Nice. Thank you, Lauren. Hold on. Talk to Elif off the air, and thanks for listening to us at WGNRadio.com. Phil Vitale, restaurant critic, Chicago Tribune. Hi, Phil. How are you?
Hi, John. I'm good.
How would you have done in our little contest there, my friend?
I would have done fairly well, possibly above average. I had never heard the Childish Gambino song before, and I don't have any idea who Estelle is. I knew the others.
I'm shocked. You're hip enough.
Apparently not.
You seem to be pretty contemporary on a lot of things.
I do what I can, but, you know, the quizzes like this can be very humbling.
They can be. Well, you know, it's easy for me to sound smart because I put it together, but were you to put together a list, I'm sure I'd only get half. But,
well, I'd include at least a song from the band America, though probably wouldn't have America in the...
That was my problem. I mean, there's no Ventura Highway in that mix because that doesn't use the word America.
Right. Although, can't you use the Ventura Highway to get from sea to shining sea, or am I mixed up geographically? So you could make it work if you had to, I'm saying.
Well, you make your list and play it for me another day.
All right, fine.
In the meantime, let's talk about some of the things that Phil Vitale is writing about, the restaurant critic for the Chicago Tribune. By the way, we went to the Bohemian place in Ravenswood since you and I last spoke. Band of Bohemia. You like that place pretty well, don't you?
I like that place pretty well. I especially like it because even though the menu is heavily beer focused, almost beer driven. I mean, they come up with these very creative beers that they make in house and then find menu dishes that will go with them. But they also have a very strong wine program because I don't drink very much beer, and so it's nice to go there with some of my beer guzzling friends, and they can kind of dig the interesting beers they make there, and I can still have my wine.
Band of Bohemia is a really pretty room. It's a good restaurant. It's in the Ravenswood neighborhood in the north and a little bit west in Chicago. And we were there with another couple. And when the waiter came out, I didn't remember this the first time we were there, but they made the point clear the second time. This is a beer place, but it's not like your average gastropub or brew house that serves food. It's a restaurant. But when you walk in, they go, "So here's our beers, and then we pair the food to go with our beers, not the other way around." I never I don't think of it that way. I think that is a food forward place is what it is.
And I think it's food primarily as well, but they do make a point, as you said, of letting you know that the beer flavors are what drive the creativity that goes into the menu.
Yeah, and fair enough. And so two of us got beers, and then two of them, Brenda and I didn't get a beer. Brenda didn't drink beer, and I had a cocktail. But it was all really good. In fact, the food was delicious, and it always is at Band of Bohemia. Here's my point, though. And it's not inexpensive. It's not super expensive. But, you know, for the four of us, there was hundreds of dollars on the table there.
Mm-hmm.
A couple hundred bucks. I got the pasta, and it's like these three tubes of pasta that are stuffed with different things, and then with kind of interesting sauce on top. It was
like a manicotti trio.
Yes, and it was delicious. And each tube was a different kind of stuff inside, and none of it was red sauce, which is my go-to. So I'm like, oh, I'll try this, and it was so good. But Phil, I just got three of them, and they weren't really big tubes. And I'm thinking, what the hell's the matter with you people? You could have given me 11 tubes, and I would have eaten all of them. The pasta can't cost that much. I'm willing to pay good money for a good restaurant, but why can't they give me more food?
You should ask them.
Yeah.
I mean, honest to goodness, one of these days, you know, when you sit there saying, you could tell the waiter, boy, this is good. I wish there was more of it. I'm still getting hungry here. you know, if they're smart, then they see what you're spending there anyway. Someone's going to run back and get you two more tubes.
Yeah, but I don't want them to do. Oh, sure enough. I mean, maybe that would work, but that's not why I would bring it up. I would bring it up just to give them honest customer feedback, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
But I don't think I'm alone in that, and I don't think they are alone in that. I think a lot of restaurants these days don't, you know, I'm not going to Gibson's for an 82-ounce steak, but could you give me enough to fill me up? And sometimes these trending hot restaurants don't give you very big portions.
Yeah, I get it. I mean, this is one of these positions that I've never walked out of a restaurant hungry. I mean, even when the places, even, you know, back in the Charlie Trotter days when he was, you know, doing these really, you know, small bites for all the rest of it, but in the course of a 8 or 9, you know, meals and the bread will sometimes come along and all the rest of it, I was well aware that I had overshot my caloric allowance for
yeah.
the day.
Maybe if I, and we weren't pinching pennies, I guess I could have ordered more food. And I know that the idea is to share these days, and I said, no, I'm not going to share.
This is my dinner. You
I know.
Dinner.
And so we kind of did it that way, even though they were suggesting to us that we share it. Like, they brought out a carrot for us. They did. It was a big old carrot. And it was the most dang delicious carrot you ever had. And
right.
So then my buddy goes, well, could you cut that into 4 pieces? And so they cut the carrot into 4 pieces, and we all had a bite of the carrot, and it was really good. But they could have given us a pile of carrot. Now, we could have ordered that thing 7 times, right? We could have ordered more carrots.
Right.
But it's a carrot. Come on.
It's a carrot.
It's a carrot.
You hog that whole carrot to yourself?
No, but I mean,
are you Bugs Bunny?
I'm not ordering filet here. You guys, if it's that good and we order carrots, I think they could give you more of them when they bring that item out. That was my point.
Mm-hmm.
All right, now that's my little observation. And I don't want to pick on Band of Bohemia because I'm going to go there again. It's a good place, as you've told us before, to go for a drink and a little side. It's a fun menu. It's a well done. They have a great seating area in the front where if you arrive early, you can have a cocktail, and they even have some fun little board games out there to play. So
it's very funky interior. They have all these interesting patterns and chairs that are one style in one part of the room and a different style in the other part of the room. It's a lot of fun. It's a lot to take in visually.
It is.
And, you know, and that's where I think it's more where the Bohemian influence comes in with the idea of all these different styles and textures of design. We say Bohemian too often in beer. People are going to be expecting to go in there and get the veal schnitzel, and that's not what's going to be on the menu.
Nope. The food is delicious there. By the way, Olive, you're listening to this. What are you thinking, Olive?
There's a movie on Netflix called Always Be My Maybe with that comedian Ali Wong, and there's a whole scene where Keanu Reeves is her boyfriend, and he treats her and her two friends out to dinner, and they go to this really high-end place, and there's a whole scene about the tiny dishes that are served at these high-end places.
Thank you.
I died. That was like the only scene I loved much.
And again, I don't need to overstate this point, but I'll just do it one last time. Band of Bohemia, I'm going to go there again. I think you should go there, and you will enjoy it. But,
I like Band of Bohemia, too.
Is just the way it is now. This is just the way it is. And you can spend more money, and you'll get more food. But by and large, the sharing concept, or even if you order the whole thing for yourself, I think the portions are a little small. You reviewed a play, Stephanie Izzard's Cabra and Chris Pandel's Sierra make Hoxton a dining destination. The hip hotel that opened in Fulton Market April 1st is not subtitled a Boca Restaurant Group production, but it wouldn't be a stretch to say so. What are you talking about here?
Well, the Boca Restaurant Group has Boca and all of Stephanie Izzard's restaurants and a few others. And Chris Pandel and Stephanie have 2 or 3 restaurants within the Boca Group. Each of them, Chris, among other things, has he created Belena, which unfortunately is not open now. It's still recovering from that fire, and he's at Swift and Sons, the steakhouse that's just a block away from the Hoxton. Stephanie has all the restaurants in Chicago with the word goat in it, I think, almost. And so this, so yes, the, both restaurants are under the Boca Group umbrella, and even the downstairs cocktail lounge slash live music venue, which has no food, so I didn't mention it, is a Boca operation.
The Duck Duck Goat, some of the best food I've ever had in the city. I think that stuff is amazing. People know Girl and the Goat, now Little Goat Diner as well.
Right.
So this
is a goat in the title.
So, what's the vibe of this place? What kind of food are we getting here?
We're talking about Cabra now. That is, it is Peruvian influenced. Stephanie took her team down to Peru for a few weeks and kind of immersed themselves in the food and ate everywhere they could find a place to eat. And she just sort of played with those flavors on this. She acknowledges that she's not trying to do quote authentic unquote Peruvian. She's just making a fun place with those kind of flavors that are identified with Peruvian food. Peruvian, after all, is its own melting pot of a cuisine. So anyway, but it's up on the roof, which is the 12th floor. It's, it can be open air when the weather's right, but it has a roof over it so that when the weather's not right or not ideal, they can still have a nice time out there, and you can still get a pretty view when you have that rooftop. And the hotel pool is just to the side and in full view of a good part of the, of the, of the dining room. Not that I've seen yet in all my visits I've seen anybody actually in the pool. It's a small pool, but it's there, and that's where you are. And it's because, as I said, Chicago has an almost insatiable appetite for rooftop restaurants. If you're on a rooftop, people are going to be in there. If they're just slinging drinks or they're having some food, they, Chicagoans love rooftop bars. And Stephanie Eisert has kind of a Midas touch when it comes to restaurants in general. All her places are packed all the time. And so I said, putting Stephanie Eisert on a rooftop is almost unfair to everybody else.
Because really?
Stephanie, so of course we're going, and it's on a roof.
We're going
right now.
Oh, my
goodness. I am so there. And every time I went in there, it was, the place was packed too deep at the bar, and there's more than one bar, and it didn't matter. And yeah, it's a very fun atmosphere. And you might find it a little on the noisy side, because full dining rooms are never quiet.
No kidding.
And yeah, once you get people... I was up at a restaurant that is specifically designed to be quiet, and it was good, and you could have a conversation, and there weren't there very many tables. But everybody at the table was having a conversation, so you could not honestly say, I'm in a quiet space right now. I can talk, and I don't have to raise my voice, but everybody in the room was taking advantage of the fact that they could converse.
Now, that was a different restaurant. This place, different. You say, is conversation challenge. The point being that you can engineer a restaurant to be a little easier on the ears.
Right.
A lot of restaurateurs are not interested in that. They like the buzz.
And well, also, they like the numbers. I mean, if you, one of the things you have, if you're going to be a quiet restaurant, the first thing you have to be is small in scale. Because once you get, if you seat 75 people in an enclosed space, unless they're not having fun, it's going to be some noise.
I got 2 minutes left. I just want to wrap this up with Cabra, which is middle-sized plates you write include a creative inside-out tarma salada.
Yeah, it's typically a Greek spread, and it just kind of played with it a little bit.
Ah. I like that. A pasta is a strength, you wrote, particularly the lamb-filled manti, which is a Turkish dumpling with cumin spiced yogurt and charred tomato sauce. That sounds good.
It is. You know, Chris Pandel, when he was a Bellina and when he created the Bristol, he liked to cook with Mediterranean flavors, and he got away from that a little bit, more to the Italian side with Bellina and definitely more with the Swift and Son Steakhouse. And so now he's doing Mediterranean food at this Sierra and having an awful lot of fun doing it.
Manta, my Turkish producer reminds me, not manta. Of the main courses, you write, seek out the bradetto, a lively fish stew. You like that?
That is really good. I mean, if you think of any kind of fish stew, you think of French fish stew, or you think of Chipotle, San Francisco. I'm blanking on the name. I'm so sorry. But yeah, this is a fish stew. They got some razor clams. They got little neck clams. They got some morcilla, which is blood sausage, in there. A little bit of chorizo, the Spanish kind, and the sauce is kind of a tomato, has tomatoes in it, and then they have a little Middle Eastern spice with harissa kind of worked in there.
You also wrote, keep an eye out for the cap steak, a ribeye cut that's smaller but more modestly priced, generally under $30. So kind of a mix at this Peruvian-inspired Cabra with two of the big names in restauranting in the Chicago area. The restaurant you give 2 stars, 2 out of 4. I'm a little surprised. It sounded like we were on our way to a 2.5 or 3.
Mm-hmm.
And this is on North Green Street in Chicago. Okay.
Yeah. Two for Sierra and 3 for Cabra.
Pardon me, yeah, Sierra and Cabra. So, there it is. So the one we've been describing, Cabra, gets 3. Sierra you mentioned also, and that's the one that gets 2.
There's
right,
the one with the brodetto and the pastas.
Yeah. Okay. Hey, good to talk to you, Phil Vitale.
Sure.
We will visit in person, I'm sure, soon, but thanks for being on the phone for us today. Have a great 4th of July, too, by the way.
Thank you. You do the same, and be careful out there.
Yeah, I know. People get busy and sometimes crazy over the 4th of July, especially when the weather is warm, and we have at least that.
Thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
Every day.
Here's John Williams.
Problem is... Mm-mm. Well, the problem is we know the questions, but we don't always know the answers. That's why we bring guests in. And we got another couple of good ones coming your way in this hour. It's 10 after 2. Thanks for joining us on the John Williams Show. We're in the Allstate Skyline Studio until 3. The Illinois Broadcasters Association this year judged our Mincing Rascals Roundtable podcast best in the state of Illinois. We just got the big... sort of a crystal obelisk a couple of weeks ago. We normally record that on Thursdays. We recorded it today because the holiday is tomorrow. Not everybody could get together. So the Mincing Rascals assembled just a short while ago, and we'll post our new podcast about 5 o'clock this evening. That's usually when it drops on Thursday.
It was a good one.
I thought it was, although... I'm going to play back just part of it just to see what the audience's reaction is here. You know, we don't take calls during the podcast. And the reason we're going to play back part of it is because I think I'll get a lot of support and you guys won't for the positions that we staked out.
So how does that work for you when you think that usually?
What do you mean?
When you're most certain that the world is going to be on your side.
I always think there's a parade behind me. I turn around, right. There's nobody there. But this time I think there's going to be a parade. And I'm not doing that to slight you, Steve, or Eric, or Scott, but frankly, it is novel enough that I'd like to just sort of test the waters on this. We'll play that back in the second half hour, a little after 2:30. We'll also then be joined by Dan Lamonti, who is a national security reporter at the Washington Post and is writing about the conditions that those kids are being kept in, and some adults as well. In Texas, the people that are crossing the river, what are the conditions? Is it as bad as you've heard? And what should we be doing about it? I'll tell you, some of the harshest reporting I was reading this week was on FoxNews.com. We'll go there a little after 2:30. So I don't know if you've been following the World Cup, but if you're just now catching up with it and yesterday watched that match, that was some exciting soccer. The match between the U.S. and France was really extraordinary, too. So one more for the U.S. women in the World Cup March. Brittany Arnold joined us yesterday to sort of preview it. She's the Chicago Fire sidelines reporter. So she covers the men, but she knows soccer. And she did a great job for us yesterday on the women's side. And she joins us in studio now. Thanks for coming in. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks for having me.
You watched the match yesterday. Day two.
I did, and that was quite an exciting match, and we expected it to be. We knew that England was going to come out wanting to win, and unfortunately the U.S. were just stronger.
I watched the last two matches, so I don't know anything about soccer. I watched these two, but it's just like, to me, when I watch some soccer on TV, you know, not World Cup, it seems to be more patient, and there's a lot of passing, and there doesn't seem to be the urgency. From the very beginning to the end, it's like these ladies were sprinting, and they were advancing the ball, and there was a lot of shots, and there was a lot of exciting moments. Is that a fair characterization of what I saw?
Absolutely, and this is the women's 11th consecutive win in World Cup action. So that just shows you not only how strong and talented this team is, but we saw yesterday when we talked in the show about Megan Rapinoe not being in the starting lineup, we ended up finding out that was a hamstring injury. But Kristen Press came in and she did exactly what she was supposed to do. She scored in the 10th minute, you know, just as the match was starting. So these women are so talented, and we saw that yesterday, even with the depth of the bench behind Jill Ellis.
And I thought the same about the girls from England, too. They were attacking. They were struck me as being a very talented team.
They absolutely are. And I know I was reading a lot of news and media surrounding the match, and the England fans were very upset about the VAR situation toward the end of the match. And I think that, listen, when you're in
this... What does VAR mean?
So VAR is the system that they use in the World Cup and in soccer to check on, it's like a replay system.
Instant replay, yeah.
Yeah. So, oh yeah, for those of you that don't, that aren't familiar with the sport. And yesterday I was sitting on the couch watching the match, and when England had the penalty, I was at the edge of my seat like, oh my God. Oh my gosh. They're going to do this now in the semifinal. Like, I couldn't believe.
You didn't want them to use it. They have to use it.
I thought they got the call wrong.
Are you talking about the penalty or the offsides?
No, the penalty.
The penalty.
Yes.
So describe that scene. What was happening there?
So what they had said happened was, I believe that the England player was kind of nicked in the boot, I believe, or the leg.
I didn't see that. Right, and I think, is this what happens? It looks like she's got a shot at the goal, and
right.
Then our player tripped her. She's down. She's denied that, so now she gets a free kick.
Correct.
And people were losing their minds.
I was losing my mind.
Because it doesn't look like she was tripped.
It did not. I'm not a ref,
yeah.
And I would never want to be one of today's.
And then when they look at the instant replay, they judge that, yes, she was tripped, so she gets the free kick. How often does that kick go in?
I definitely see, I'm not a professional soccer player, again, so I'm saying this from my perspective. I see a penalty kick as, you know, from a goalkeeper's perspective, it's a 50-50 shot. You're either going to left or you're going to go right. And you don't know what the person in front of you is going to be doing. So from a goalkeeper's perspective, it's a toss-up, right? It's a coin toss. You have to decide which way you're going to go. For a player, I feel like, to relate it to another sport, like maybe a free throw, right? We watch basketball and we're like, okay, you should not miss your free throws.
That's the way I feel.
That's sort of how I feel about penalty kicks.
Yeah, no kidding. In fact, hey, producer Elif, can you look up what percentage of, are those called free kicks?
There's free kicks and penalty kicks, but yes.
Look up what percentage of penalty kicks or free kicks in soccer does the person make. I would be surprised if it was less than 60, right? Because even if I guess right, I also have to stop it. And that's pretty point blank. Well, our goalie who plays in Chicago, she's on the Chicago women's team, she made the stop. That was very exciting.
I mean, and you have to remember, too, the amount of pressure. I mean, can you imagine these women wait this many years to get to this moment in time? And it's you up against another woman at the same professional level, and all you have to do is get it into the back of the net. The amount of and I know that people say in general about athletes, right? They have to face the pressure. This is part of their job. But you can't deny the emotion and everything that they must have been feeling in that moment. And it's devastating. You work so hard to get to that point in a World Cup, but the U.S. women's national team is just up there in that conversation with one of the greatest sports teams of all time. And that's in any sport. I mean, these women have won, what is it, 3 World Cups, looking to get their 4th. I mean, under Jill Ellis, they've won 2. So this is just, they're an exceptional team, and they have the depth to continue.
There is a move that one of our women made on the right side where she passed the ball between the legs of her defender, ran around the defender, and then picked up the ball where she left off, literally just threading the person in front of her, running around, and then she advanced the ball, and I don't remember if that led to a goal or not, but it was just some of the fanciest footwork I've ever seen.
They are incredible. And I think, too, you sometimes have that conversation. I think we talked a little bit about it yesterday, the division between men and women sports. And sometimes you can have that conversation depending on what the sport is. I feel like in soccer, it's like you watch these women play and the talent that they have and the moves that they have are right up there with what.
What did you think of that offsides call? Because then England scored. It was 2-2 for a couple of seconds, and then they pulled that goal off. The woman evidently had crossed the line or was in front of the place that you're supposed to be.
Right.
So she was offsides. Their goal is negated. It looked like they got the call right in that case.
Yeah, and it's such a high-pressure situation. And I remember when I first started learning soccer 9 years ago when I got into the industry, and offsides was the one thing that took me a long time to understand. I was like, okay, I grew up watching football and basketball and baseball and all these sports, and I'm like, I don't understand how you can call something, you know, offsides, like, you know what, and that I think for a lot of people that maybe don't watch soccer all the time, it's difficult. What do you mean it's offsides? Like, what does that mean? Like, she had the ball, she was running, she was there. So I think it was the right call yesterday, and I think that these refs have a ton of pressure in these, you know, decision settings for the, like, a World Cup semifinal or final or quarterfinal, and they have to get the call right, and they have to take the time. It's more important to say, okay, let me check VAR, let me check, let me make sure that I'm making the right call, because that one goal would have changed the entire game.
Think about that. I mean, maybe we don't win that match. What happens if it's a draw?
So it would have to, then it would go to, I believe in the World Cup, it goes extra time and then penalties.
Oh, they would have.
Nobody scores.
So they will have a winner.
They have to, right? In the semifinal match, yes.
By the way, producer Aleph, were you able to find out what percentage of the penalty kicks go in?
Penalty kicks are scored about 75% of the time, John.
Oh, 75. Yeah.
That's.
And there's 25%, and that was us. So now what's the next match then?
So they're going to be playing in the final. They'll be playing the winner of today's match. So how it works with the World Cup is the U.S. will go to the final, which is on the 7th, and they will play the winner of today's other semi-match, and then they have a third place. So basically whoever wins today plays the U.S. in the final, and then England and the team that loses today will play each other for the third place.
And today it's Sweden and the Netherlands, I think it is.
Yes.
And so where's Brazil? Where's, I don't know, the South American and Central American countries? They were, I presume, in the hunt at some point, but they all lost out along the way.
They have. I think that the U.S. women's national team is too good. They are just, and the thing is, in soccer, the most important thing, too, is not only the caliber of these players, but the depth of the team. And we talked a little bit about that yesterday, too. But it is so important because it's not just about one player carrying a team like it can be in other sports. Like, you need all of the players on the pitch performing well. And we saw yesterday when Megan didn't get in that starting 11 and everybody was, oh my gosh, what are they going to do? She's been so phenomenal. What's going to happen? And I was reading the media about it, and there was a lot of stress surrounding, you know, that decision. And, you know, we found out later that it was an injury, but Kristen stepped right up and scored the first goal. I mean, you can't have a better squad than you have with the U.S. women's national team.
Yesterday, we talked a little bit about the attitude of the team and the players, and we only briefly alluded to Rapinoe's comments about the White House and stuff like that. But I think we all kind of agreed. There was some disagreement, but I think we all generally agreed that if you can walk the walk, you get to talk the talk, and a little swagger isn't a bad thing for an athlete. And I had no trouble with it at all. Then I pick up my phone today, and I see on TMZ that some of the members of the U.S. women's team were at Disney World at Epcot Center on Sunday, and were drinking and getting too loud and rowdy, and eventually got arrested and thrown out, and then I guess released in time to play. But I thought, oh, you guys, what are we doing?
Yeah, it goes back to the conversation of, at the end of the day, these women are just that, right? They're women, just like LeBron James is a dad and a father and a guy, but they have to be held to a higher standard. And I definitely, not only as a journalist, but as an individual, believe that for athletes that are at the highest level, you know, being paid at the highest level on the biggest stages in the world, they have to be held to a high standard. They have to.
Well, they've
it's just part of the job.
And even if they don't like it, even if you could say, well, that's not fair, I should be treated like anybody else, guess what? That's not the way it is.
Nope, it's
people
not.
Do look at you. So you have to. So all of the swagger, all of the cockiness that they display on the pitch, if that is who you are, and if there's some advantage to that because it's intimidating to your opponents, then I don't have any problem with that. But if in this day and age you don't think that video or pictures or news is going to get out of your stupid behavior off the field, then you're in the wrong sport. You're in the wrong job. You know, that will catch up with you. And if you don't care, you don't have to care. But people do. And that's unfortunate. What's your prediction for the championship?
I mean, I definitely think the USA are going to take it. They'll get their fourth title. Jill Ellis said after the match yesterday that this is their goal. Their goal is the trophy, and they're going to do what they have to do to get that. So I see them winning. Scoreline, I think, you know, Alex Morgan scored yesterday on her 30th birthday. I think she's going to kind of sort of be pumped and fired up for the final. Maybe she'll score again on Sunday.
Is Rapino going to play?
That's a good question. I think that if it's just a hamstring injury and it's nothing serious, she's going to be going to Jill Ellis and saying, I have to play. This is the World Cup final.
Right.
So I think she's going to make it a point to do whatever she has to do. I believe, you know, they have enough time to rest her in between the matches. So if I'm her, she's going to Jill Ellis and saying, you have maybe not start her, depending on how severe the injury is. I didn't see anything in that report stating, but if I'm Megan, she's going to want to play in that final.
Well, it reminds me a little bit of Kevin Durant in the NBA Finals. It's like, well, but if he gets injured, then what happens? I think, well, there's no tomorrow anyway.
Correct.
So, I mean, you don't want to ruin somebody's career. You don't want to, you know, hurt them physically beyond what they might be able to recover from. But what's the point if you don't play today? That is, if you can. If you can, then you play.
Absolutely.
And if you get injured, then you get injured. But I would sure give her the opportunity if she wanted to play and felt well enough she could contribute. Okay, well, Brittany, if folks want to watch you on the sidelines for Fire Games, how do they find you all?
Yes, we actually have a match tonight. We'll be playing Atlanta United, 7 p.m. Central. You can catch us on ESPN Plus. Pre-game is 6:45.
And if you want to go to the game, you can buy tickets.
Yes, we are in SeatGeek Stadium in Bridgeview, Illinois. Yes, come out and see us.
You get about 20,000 for the games, right?
We get a good crowd. We have a great atmosphere, and the Chicago Fire has a great team, great organization. So, yeah, come see us, and we have a lot of games in July and August, a lot.
Brittany Arnold reports from the sidelines of the Fire game. Watch them on ESPN Plus, and thanks for joining us. Maybe at least one more conversation with you after the ladies' final match.
Yes, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Steve. John Williams here. What are you doing, Ella?
Well, you're listening to a Kids These Days song, which featured Chance the Rapper many years ago, and that's what introduced me to Chance the Rapper. And this is a fan favorite you're listening to. Chance the Rapper announced that he's dropping his first ever album this month.
Oh, now you got the gas. Oh, now you want to laugh. Oh, now you need a cab. That's true, though.
That's funny. As much as you think of Chance the Rapper in Chicago and across the world now, I mean, he's a big deal. This is his first album that he's released, right?
Right. Because he even has music or lyrics that talk about not using a label.
Right. I know. The world has changed. Chance is going mainstream. He's got a. I don't know the name of the label that he's working with. It's not his own, right? Who's releasing this album? Do you have that in front of you?
I actually don't think it's in the story that I was reading, but I don't know.
Chance dropping a new album, and it's weird, but this is his debut album. We don't have that yet. It's to be released, but that was a part of the music news today. It's 2:38 on WGN, so part of the news today, of course, is everybody anticipating the 4th of July celebration in Washington, D.C. tomorrow. Writing about it in the Washington Post is Dan Lamoff. Dan, you're on WGN Radio in Chicago. Thanks for joining us. How are you today?
My pleasure. Very well.
What's the weather like there? What's it going to be like tomorrow?
Hot and steamy, 90s the last several days. Looks like it'll be up around 100 if you count the heat index tomorrow, and we're looking at some storms possibly as well.
Isn't that the way? Just when you want to do something outdoors, weather threatens. It's been that way in Chicago all spring and summer long. Not good.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, thunderstorms here are kind of a fact of life.
So, but not a fact of life is that the president would have such a hand in the 4th of July ceremonies. Is my understanding is that the Bushes and Clinton and Obama more recently were not as intimately involved in the 4th of July celebration. What's happening in Washington, D.C. tomorrow?
We'll have a pretty large expansion to what you typically see on the 4th of July here. Obviously, the 4th of July fireworks are always a big deal in Washington, but they've been essentially doubled. And then in addition to that, there's a lot to do this week about armored vehicles appearing in the city. And we have word of a pretty broad fleet of aircraft that'll be flying over tomorrow evening, kind of prior to the fireworks, probably around the same time the president speaks, and aircraft, and in some cases, are rare to see. B-2 bomber, the F-22 fighter, the Blue Angels will be involved. I mean, pretty high profile planes.
To accommodate them, they're going to shut down the airports out there for an hour or so. Is that right?
Yeah, we're looking at the airspace and being closed actually two different times. One in the kind of the 9 o'clock hour, probably about 45 minutes to an hour for the fireworks themselves. And then we're looking at in excess of an hour earlier in the evening, assumedly when all these aircraft go by.
Right. So and the president is speaking at what time tomorrow?
The sense I have is it's early evening. I don't know that we've had anything firmly announced yet.
It's funny because I'll just read a sentence from your story. The White House referred questions about the celebration to the Interior Department, which declined to comment.
I would add on top of that the Defense Department referred questions to the White House, which referred comment to the Interior Department. So it's been that kind of week.
Well, I presume that somebody must know. I don't know why they're being secretive about it. My understanding is the president's going to speak around 6:30. There's going to be music and stuff like that, and then you'll have the fireworks when it gets dark a little later on. So I don't think there should be any big surprises there. One of the things, though, that I think we all thought we were going to get, and maybe what the president initially wanted, was a sort of Bastille Day-styled parade of military might before a reviewing stand. Wasn't that what the president originally envisioned when he thought it was when he wanted to do this on Veterans Day or something like that?
For sure. If you take it back, it was actually initially conceived as a Memorial Day idea and then pushed back to a Veterans Day idea. It was seemingly put on the shelf then. There was an announced document that was disclosed around that time that put the overall price tag of the military parade as it was envisioned at about $92 million. That would have included about $50 million in military things, which would include fuel would be a big part of it with all the aircraft, and then, you know, all of the other bells and whistles involved. We don't have a price tag at this point on this one. No one's really willing to entertain that question right now. But certainly, just given based on the aircraft involved, we're looking at a multi-million dollar affair for sure.
The number that's being advertised is a $2.5 million being diverted from the Park Service to cover some of these costs. Typically, you write, this 4th of July fireworks show costs $2 million, and we're $2.5 plus here. I must tell you, though, well, I guess that deserves our attention because that represents about 5% of the Park Service budget. It's not a giant number. $2 million is not a lot of money for anything in a federal budget.
No, it's really not. It appears that the DOD, Defense Department portion of this is on top of that 2.5. So, I mean, at that point, we're probably looking at, you know, close to double digits, if not more.
Yeah, right. It's controversial because the president is going to give a speech, though, whatever the military display is. I want to talk to you about that. But I suppose this has just really got people on edge because you never know what Donald Trump is going to say, right?
One of the challenges for the military here is, you know, he's invited the Joint Chiefs to to participate. And in some case, you'll have the you'll have Chairman General Joe Dunford there, and a number of other generals alongside him. And that in itself is not uncommon. I mean, there are a lot of events where you would see that sort of brass around the president. But then you put the microphone in front of the president with them in uniform, and that creates a lot of problems, in the eyes of people who kind of watch that civil-military dynamic and trying to not politicize the military.
When Democrats were in office, though, did they not control the tickets? Weren't they able to give them to their donors or agency heads, or is that unique this time?
The donor aspect is pretty unique. It's not uncommon for tickets to be distributed to the various federal departments. We were told today that 5,000 tickets have been sent to the Pentagon to distribute as they see fit. Assumably, some of those are going to go to political appointees, but plenty of others will not. But then you add in the donor aspect of this, and that gets uncomfortable for a lot of people.
So how significant will the military presence be then?
On the ground, I think you're looking at hundreds, but not thousands, as probably would have been envisioned in a military parade, kind of an Bastille Day idea. But when you start adding in all these aircraft, we're probably looking at upwards of, 15, 18, 20, 25 aircraft going overhead. Air Force One, I mean, the list goes on and on.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think a lot of what you're going to see is going to be in the air as opposed to in the city.
Right, but say there's 100 vehicles. You don't mean 100 people, right? Right? You mean 100 vehicles or military?
No. It'll be small on the ground. We're looking at a few hundred people on the ground.
Right.
In terms of vehicles, they've brought in two tanks.
Yeah.
And it's still unclear where those will end up. As of an hour or two ago, they're still under tarp in a train yard. I actually drove down there.
I understand. They've actually had to figure out the logistics. One time they wouldn't fit under an underpass, some of these military vehicles, so they got to go another route. Yeah, maybe this idea that it's being cobbled together at the last minute is true, because for all of the fuss about the military hardware, we're talking about a couple of tanks and a few armored personnel carriers. There's not going to be these rows of missiles on launchers being trucked by the president. It's not going to be like that. And I don't know why I'm stressing that point, but I guess I'm also trying to tell people you don't need to be too stressed by it. Those things will be there, but it's not going to be that kind of a parade.
No, there will be no parade. On the ground, I mean, I shouldn't say no parade. You may have some, like drill team sort of,
yeah,
that kind of marching.
Yeah.
But no, you're not going to see, 25 minutes of vehicles going by or anything like that.
Yeah.
The tension on the tanks, though, has become, how do you move something quite that heavy in a way that doesn't damage roads, sidewalks, things of that sort? There's a specific way they can truck it on a very, very large, low trailer, the kind of thing you'd see a house on. I mean, something,
yeah,
that size or larger. But as of today, it hasn't been done yet. They've moved the personnel carriers down near the Lincoln Memorial, but the tanks haven't moved yet.
This is interesting, too. And before we get to the what's going to fly overhead, they also wanted to project an image from the Apollo 1969 moon mission onto the Washington Monument. Okay, that's all American, and it's 50 years for that. Everybody's paying attention to Apollo this year. What's the controversy about projecting an image of Apollo 11 on the Washington Monument?
I'm not actually aware of all of those details.
Pardon me, I'm reading from a story that maybe you didn't author, but I'll just finish that paragraph then, if I may. Typically, the agency does not allow projected images on monuments or historic structures on the grounds that they should be preserved in their original form. Okay, well, I'll let them work that out. What about the overhead? Is it unusual for Air Force One to make a pass, or is that kind of standard at these sorts of things?
No, Air Force One is not typically used in that way at all. It's obviously used as a prop in terms of, the president lands and you've got the blue and white aircraft behind him and that kind of idea. But to send it over in a flyover is something you don't typically hear at all.
I just have to laugh at that. I mean, because to the degree that this is about Donald Trump and not about you know, holding hands and we're all one and together. You can just imagine him looking up going, that's my plane there. Look at my plane. When, you know, like, you know, if the Navy wants to do a flyover, or if they want the Blue Angels to do the thing, that's awesome and everybody will love that. But Air Force One making a pass does, I've seen a big plane go by before and that it's the president's, I'm happy for him, but I don't know that that's such a show, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's a slow-moving jetliner. You know, it's not like sending the Blue Angels or, you know, I mean, even some of the helicopters are, you know, at least interesting to look at.
Yeah. All right, well, so there's a little bit. So last thing there before I let you go, you know, we'll see how this all pans out, Dan. But then anything else about the timeline of these things? You know, this is what's going to happen and then that's going to happen that you can tell us about?
I mean, I think all eyes will be on this speech, at least in terms of people that are interested both politically and also in terms of whether there's kind of any troubling dynamic between politics and military here.
Yeah.
You know, the fireworks should be pretty impressive. I mean, it's going to be a very long display. I mean, typically it's 20, 25 minutes. We're looking at more like 45 tomorrow.
Okay. Well, happy birthday, America. 4th of July is tomorrow, and they're going to do it big in Washington, D.C. We'll see what else comes of that. Dan Lamoth writes about it in Washington Post. Thanks for joining us today, Dan.
My pleasure.
250. We'll see. We'll see. let's come back after a quick break. And I want to just preview for you a little of the Mincing Rascals podcast, which we recorded today. We normally do it on Thursday. If you're a Mincing Rascal fan, thanks for listening as you do. A new one's going to drop in a couple of hours. And there was one little point that Eric and Steve and Justin made, and I was at odds with them. Tell me where you are after this. This is WGNRadio.com. I'm John Williams at WGN Radio. The White Sox are on the air. That Dylan Cece finally is pitching for the White Sox. His day may be over, they tell me on the radio side, but in 5 innings, 6 strikeouts. Give up a few runs. Sox are winning 4-3, I think was the last score I saw. So that's good news for Southside baseball fans. Good news for all of us. The Dow closed up at a record high of 179 points. So we dropped the Mincing Rascals podcast around 5 o'clock today. Normally we do it around 5 o'clock on Thursday. We did it early because of the holiday. I said to the gang, I said, listen, since this is the first podcast we've done, the Mincing Rascals, our weekly roundtable, since the 1st of July, when some new taxes and laws have gone into place, what do you all think about some of them? And one of them is that it's going to be tougher for you if you're caught texting and driving. If you are using your phone in an unauthorized way, talking or texting while driving, it's now a moving violation. And Eric Zorn took issue with the fact, we noticed this yesterday, that if you have the phone in your hand and you're not talking, you're not texting, you just have it in your hand, that's a violation. You cannot have your phone in your hand if you are driving in Illinois. I don't care what you're doing. They can't be there. You could be listening to music. You cannot have it in your hand. That's where we pick it up.
I think that, you know, texting and emailing and punching up podcasts in your car when it's moving, bad idea. Have I ever done it? Maybe. But at a stoplight, the law, this is the thing I objected to. I sent you a note on, John. It's like, when you're at a stoplight, that's when you're, you know, your car's stopped. You can then look down at your phone and go, okay.
Really?
Yeah.
No, hold on. Whole new conversation. At a stoplight, you think it's wise?
Yeah.
That's a good time to check your phone?
I think it's responsible. I think it's the responsible.
You're looking at your phone and the lights turn green and there's 22 car lengths ahead of you, but you're texting Tim about something. Assuming
that's
somebody
a nuisance.
Named Tim.
I don't think it's as much of a danger. What I would say.
A little tap on the horn. And we're going to make a law about that? I think it's fine. I think it's safe. I think it's fine to look at your phone when you're at a stoplight.
We're going the opposite direction now. So instead of cracking down, you're going to broaden the legal use of texting while driving if you're at a stoplight.
If you're stopped at a stoplight.
If your car
but your
is
foot's
stopped.
On the brake. You're not in park. Right? Just to be clear, your foot's on the brake. You're at a stoplight.
If you can point me to one traffic accident that was caused by someone looking at their phone at a stoplight.
Somebody rear-ended them because the light ahead of them was green.
And they were on their phone.
And they were on their phone, and they didn't look up because it's okay in Eric's world to text while you're at a light.
If you rear-end somebody, you're at fault.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Fine, thank you.
So you have every right not to move for any reason.
I'm going to put that on the radio.
Yes, and this is your news. I got a news clip for you right there.
You are going to get excoriated. I'm going to get excoriated representing your views. That's what's going to happen. Thanks a lot, Eric. Well, that was part of the podcast. But actually, I'm not going to represent Eric's views. You know, if they get to be king someday, that it'll be okay to text when you're at a stoplight. I think Bertrand imagined a scenario where you're at the train is going by, a freight train real slow, and you're just sitting there. You know, I don't want to be a nanny about people's use of the phones. We've all been guilty of these crimes. But the pendulum is going the other way. And they think that if you are stopped at a light or a train or whatever, if you're stopped, but not in park, but you're stopped, that you ought to be able to text. That will be an okay time. But if you're moving, then you can't text. Okay, the cops could manage that. If they go by you and you're at a stoplight and they see you texting, they're not going to write you a ticket. But if you're moving, then they will. I think the cops could tell which was which. But I just wonder if you want to give them the green light on that. Give people the ability to text while they're at a light. I know we do. I know we want it. But I didn't think those guys would embrace that. I think that the only way to make it safe for everybody is that you cannot talk on your phone when you are driving, and we're not going to do that, are we? I guess I don't know what the solution is, because my idea is not very practical, and I don't want to give up my phone in the car either. But if I'm at a stoplight, I don't text anymore. I've just been yelled at too much by people that love me, so I don't text it ever in the car. At least I don't think I do anymore. All right, so I don't know if that's going to be the news click or not. Maybe we could make that the news click. You think that the law should allow you to text when you're at a stoplight. But I'm telling you, Eric goes, but then you won't be in a crash because you're stopped. I'm like, Eric, you're going to have your phone down in your lap. Your nose is going to be looking at it. And someone's going to rear-end you because they see, green light, green light. And they're coming along at 50 miles an hour and they're going to slam into your rear.
Well... Huh. Well, that does make sense. Okay. So intern Jay and I were having a debate over that minute ago.
How so?
Because I thought the example that you gave was faulty, because you said when you're at a stoplight and you have your phone in your hand, you can rear-end somebody.
No, but somebody's going to rear-end you. Yeah. Yeah.
But that's because, that makes sense.
No, and I thought you see my scenario. Yeah. So.
But isn't there a condition in the law under which you can use your phone as long as you are at a stop sign?
No.
Okay,
well,
then I'm...
Maybe Elif needs to look that up for us. We're out of time now, but maybe everybody will have to look that up. I don't... In all of the reporting about it, I have not seen that if you are at a stoplight. I think this may...
There's just a list of conditions under which you can use your phone.
I think if you're in park, you can. Like, if you've pulled over to the side of the road and you're in park, you can. But I think if your foot is on the brake... or the gas, you can't text with your phone. It should be that simple. Park makes sense to me. I would carve out the exception for you there.